Bicentennial 2.
Welcome to Bicentennial 2. This is the second program in a 10-part series featuring guest speakers from America's Midwest discussing the impact of ethnic groups on the formation of our American civilization. Bicentennial 2 is a production of the Humanities Series, Midwestern Center, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. In this second program, Professor Richard Barksdale of the University of Illinois at Urbana looks at the blacks in Illinois.
The black man's history in Illinois, beginning with the settlement of Jean-Baptiste Pointe du Sable in a log house at the mouth of the Chicago River in 1779, has been a history marked by creative turbulence, constructive tension, and ceaseless challenge and struggle. In a sense, his Illinois history is a tale of one city, the city of Chicago, where, beginning with a small stream of slave fugitives who settled there in the 1840s, the number of blacks increased to 1,000 in 1860, to 15,000 by 1890, and by 1920 to a towering 109,458. The 1970 census records indicate that 1,421,745 blacks live in Illinois, with 1,102,620 of that number residing in Chicago. From the beginning, even before 1818, when Illinois became a state, there was widespread hostility to the settlement of blacks in the state. For instance, in 1813, the Illinois Territorial Legislature passed a bill requiring justices of peace to order every incoming free black to leave the territory. Those who already resided in the territory had to register with the Clerk of Common Pleas and pay 50 cents. After statehood in 1818, the prevailing mood of anti-black bias intensified, and the consequence was the exclusion law, passed by the state legislature in 1847, but not implemented until 1853. Other Midwestern states, Ohio, Indiana, and Iowa, also adopted exclusion provisions, but Illinois' black law was the most severe ever passed by a so-called free state. The record indicates that Illinois did not want slavery established within its borders, but it also did not want any blacks freed from slavery residing within its borders. The record also indicates that the anti-slavery activities in Chicago, Galesburg, and Quincy in the 1840s and 1850s were effectively counterbalanced by the pro-slavery attitudes in Springfield, Alton, and Cairo. The death of the abolitionist martyr, Elijah Lovejoy, in Alton in 1837 attests to the mood of the mob in the southern part of the state. Lovejoy died with 5 bullets in his body when he attempted to install a printing press for abolitionist purposes in Alton. The miracle is that despite the exclusionist mood throughout the state, blacks kept coming via river steamboats, canal barges, overland stages, and by foot. Fugitives from slavery, they were poverty-stricken and fear-ridden. Their goal was Canada, but most often their flight ended in Chicago. Between 1840 and 1850, the black population of the state climbed from 3,598 to 5,436. By 1860, it had climbed to 7,628. Indeed, when the irrepressible conflict flared forth in 1861 and black troops were finally accepted in the army in 1863, 1,811 blacks joined up to serve as Illinois' colored contingent on distant southern battlefields. After the Union victory in 1865 and the death of Illinois' great statesman, Abraham Lincoln, the state's mood and attitude toward blacks changed swiftly. Its legislature was the first in the nation to adopt the 13th Amendment to the Constitution. The black presence became an accepted reality, not just in Illinois, but throughout the Midwest. Before 1860, the black man's migratory trek had been ever northward on rivers and streams via the Underground Railway. But during the 1870s, migratory patterns changed and tended to follow the railroad lines to lands of opportunity west and southwest of the Mississippi. By his own testimony, Benjamin Papp Singleton, the self-styled Moses of the colored exodus, led 82,000 blacks from Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama to sunny Kansas in 1879 and 1880. Despite these shifts in black migratory patterns, Chicago continued to be the magnet that drew most of America's migrants who were on the move during the Gilded Age of unparalleled economic growth of the 1870s and 1880s. In 1867, George Mortimer Pullman had founded the Pullman Palace Car Company, and by 1880 had built his company town 10 miles south of what were then the Chicago city limits. With the development of the railroads, Chicago not only became the nation's foremost commercial center, but became also what Carl Sandburg called the hog butcher of the world. Indeed, on warm summer days, an offensive stench hovered over Chicago's south side, but its fumes were a fragrant essence to the nostrils of the Swifts and the Amors, who profited from the stockyard activities. Inevitably, Chicago's economic growth was a boon to the city's black community. The black Pullman Porter quickly became a fact of American life. And although he was denied the rights and benefits of union organization for many years, the Pullman Porter became a man of stable income in the community. Indeed, Julius Avendorf, George Pullman's black assistant to the president of the company, emerged during the 1890s as black Chicago's social leader. An avowed social elitist who objected to the blurring of class lines in the black community, Avendorf was reputed to be personally acquainted with, quote, more millionaires than any other colored man in Chicago, unquote. He was master of ceremonies at every major event and was the recognized social arbiter from 1886 up through 1910. However, Chicago's economic and industrial prominence brought problems as well as benefits. A growing proletariat of workers competed for housing and services, and racial tensions intensified as blacks, Poles, Irish, and Italians struggled for social, economic, and political leverage. Working men's slums proliferated, city services were taxed, political corruption became a fact of city life, and the black ghetto crystallized. And then there was the disastrous fire of 1871, followed by the typhoid epidemics of the 1890s. But the most serious after effects of economic prosperity were the labor strikes and the conflicts between labor and management in the various industries. In all of these, the Pullman strike of 1894, the stockyard strike of 1904, the Teamster strike of 1905, black scab labor was used to break the strikes. Inevitably, hostility increased against the black community. Particularly was this true during the Teamster strike of 1905, which precipitated a mini-race riot, a sort of prelude for the bloody riot of 1919. But the black man's coming to Illinois did not bring only tensions and conflict. His coming brought music, laughter, the cakewalk, and the minstrel show. For somehow, out of slavery there came the blues, the field holler, and the work song, filtered down through the centuries, no doubt from dim African backgrounds. And then, with the 1890s, through the musical genius of Scott Joplin, there came ragtime, that curious blend of European marching music and black syncopation. The immense popularity of the Joplin rags encouraged Robert Motz, black Chicago's cafe, saloon, and gambling house kingpin, to open in 1905 the famed Pekin Theater. Advertised as the South Side's temple of music, the Pekin attracted a stream of talent from St. Louis, New Orleans, and Kansas City. Joplin played there. Joe Jordan wrote his The Pekin Rag while working there. Will Marion Cook, an accomplished violinist, worked there, and so did his lovely wife, the actress Abby Mitchell. Shelton Brooks, who directed the Pekin Theater Orchestra, composed such all-time tunes as Some of These Days and Doc Town Strutter's Ball while working there. Chicago came into musical prominence, however, with the arrival of jazz, another originally black musical form which also had dim African origins. The original exponents of this form of expression were cornetists like Sweet Buddy Bolden, who blew his horn at Johnson Park in New Orleans to summon the faithful. He also played songs like Callous Love at a place called the Tin Type Hall, a morgue for slain hustlers during the daytime and a dance hall quivering with rhythm at night. History records that the musical career of Buddy Bolden ended when he ran amok in a parade on June 5, 1907 and had to be placed in Angola, Louisiana's hospital for the insane. But the jazz beat that Bolden had heard in the dances in New Orleans Congo Square in the 1870s did not end when he was removed from the scene. Ferdinand Jelly Roll Martin, a Creole from New Orleans, developed a solid jazz piano style when he began to play piano in 1902 in the whorehouses of Storyville, New Orleans' famed Red Light District. By 1908, Martin had formed his band and started traveling to St. Louis and to California. Another band formed about the same time was Emmanuel Perez's Creole Band, which in 1914 played at the Grand Theater at Chicago's 31st and State. It is said that on this occasion, Freddie Capard, the cornetist in the Perez band, blew his horn just the way Buddy Bolden had done to summon the faithful and inaugurate the jazz era in Chicago. After 1914, jazz greats continued to flood Chicago. Jelly Roll Martin played hot piano at a nightclub called Pony Moore's, and it is estimated that by 1920, there were over 40 other well-known New Orleans jazzmen working and living in Chicago. One person of interest was Lillian Hardin, a young pianist who had taken a summer job at a Chicago music store during her vacation from Fisk University. She tried out for the piano job with Sugar Johnny and his New Orleans band. Her account of the tryout says something significant about the jazz that was being played about 1920. She said, "When I sat down to play, I asked for the music, and were they surprised? They politely told me they didn't have any music, and furthermore, never used any. I then asked, what key would the first number be in? I must have been speaking another language, because the leader said, when you hear two knocks, just start playing." Unquote. Lil Hardin went on to say that when she heard the two knocks, she quickly found the tune and the beat, was accepted as the band's pianist, and of course, never returned to Fisk University. Later, she became Mrs. Louis Armstrong. Shortly after that fabulously gifted New Orleans musician joined King Oliver's band in Chicago. Actually, the coming of jazz and the black musician to Chicago and to Illinois was a cultural byproduct of the great migration of black farm workers, tenant farmers, laborers, domestics, hustlers, and schemers from the lower and upper South during World War I. Drawn by the promise of work and booming war industries and happy to escape the racial brutalities of the South, blacks came to Illinois in great numbers to find work and a new life. They were urged to come not only through the letters that friends and relatives sent back home to them, but they were urged to come by the Great Northern Drive, sponsored by Chicago's powerful black newspaper, the Chicago Defender. More will be said later about the Defender's dynamic editor and founder, Robert Abbott. Suffice it to say at this point that there is no other instance in America's journalistic history that a weekly newspaper so successfully stimulated, manipulated, managed, and encouraged such a large mass movement of people from one region of the nation to another. It is estimated that between 1916 and 1920, 50,000 Negro migrants settled in Chicago. Similarly, it is estimated that during that same period, between 10,000 and 12,000 migrants from the Black South flooded into East St. Louis and its neighboring St. Clair industrial communities. The migration pressure was so great in the latter city that its mayor requested that the major railway lines no longer permit the importation of blacks into the East St. Louis area. It was obvious to the mayor and other municipal leaders that East St. Louis, with its black valley of vice and corruption, was ill-equipped to cope with the housing, social, and educational problems caused by the massive influx of black laborers and their families. Other factors encouraged the big migration. One was the increasing violence done to cotton farming by the boll weevil, which by 1915 had begun to ravage the one cash crop planted in the South. A second factor was the severe drop in European immigrant labor. With the outbreak of the European War in 1914, immigration fell from an all-time high of 1,218,480 in 1914 to 326,700 in 1915 and 110,618 in 1918. It was almost inevitable then that expanding northern industries would send recruitment agents into the South. The steel mills, packing houses, and foundries needed the black man's unskilled labor. Thus far, I have discussed the events of interest that touched and changed the lives of Illinois' black citizens over the years. But events without people become drab and colorless. And I propose in the balance of my talk to introduce some of the personalities who influenced black history in Illinois. Dr. Daniel Hale Williams was born of free parents in Pennsylvania and came to Chicago from Janesville, Wisconsin in 1880. After receiving his medical degree from Chicago Medical School, he quickly became identified with the best of Chicago's surgeons and developed a practice with a large number of white patients. Stressing professional integrity more than racial protest, Dr. Dan, as he was called, never developed a close bond of interest with the black community. At least that was the charge leveled against him by a rival professional named George Cleveland Hall. Actually, Daniel Hale Williams was both a dedicated professional and a quiet integrationist. In 1891, when he led the movement to found Provident Hospital, he amply demonstrated his professionalism and his interest in furthering racially integrated enterprises. By his plan, Providence opened with a racially mixed staff, and Dr. Williams made it plain that professional qualifications rather than race would govern staff appointments and the selection of interns. In other words, Provident was not to be a wholly Negro facility. It would provide professional opportunities for qualified Negro doctors and nurses and receive Negro patients. But a racially integrated staff was high on Dr. Williams' list of priorities. Fortunately, many other prominent Chicago citizens agreed with him, and when Provident received a new 65-bed facility and nursing school on Dearborn Street in 1896, Pullman, Marshall Field, and Philip R. Moore provided the land and the building. It was during the early years of his association with Provident Hospital that Dr. Williams performed a surgical feat hitherto unknown in the annals of medical history. In 1893, he performed the world's first successful suture of the human heart, or what is now popularly known as open heart surgery. The professional acclaim accorded him for his brilliant surgery did not bring him approval in the broader Negro community, however. His large white clientele made many fellow blacks suspicious of his racial loyalties. Moreover, many came to regard Provident as a black institution and the medical adjunct of Chicago's Negro Business League. Placing professionalism before race, Dr. Williams strenuously resisted every effort to change Provident Hospital from an integrated facility to an all-black hospital. In 1912, The Hospital Board of Trustees rendered a decision which he considered adverse to the best professional interests of hospital administration, and he resigned from the board and from the Negro community. In divorcing himself from Chicago's black community, Dr. Williams became a victim of the struggle between forces in the city who fought to maintain integration and those who sought to establish a self-sufficient black community with its own resources and facilities. We now know that rigid separation ipso facto breeds inequities, but there were few black leaders in the Chicago of 1912 who did not believe in the essential validity of the separate and self-sufficient black community. Our second medical doctor of note is Dr. Andrew W. Springs, who made his rendezvous with his professional destiny by serving as company doctor for the Madison Coal Company in Southern Illinois. Dr. Springs was born in Charlotte, North Carolina in 1869 of a Negro mother who had been a slave and an Indian father. Through a series of fortuitous circumstances, he was able to attend Fisk University, and following graduation in 1903 and a year of teaching in Cairo, Illinois, he put himself through the National Medical School in Chicago. When he elected to return to the mining town of Dumois in southern Illinois, he began his long association with the Madison Coal Company. His two significant achievements were his establishment in 1908 of the region's first aid class and his extensive rescue work following a fire and explosion in the North Mine at Royalton. On the latter occasion, 50 doctors were summoned to render assistance and first aid to the more than 200 miners injured in the fire and explosion. Dr. Andrews was the only one of the attending physicians who brought a pull motor with him. He used it to save many miners suffering from smoke inhalation. When he learned that there were 52 miners trapped down in a smoke-filled shaft, Dr. Andrews went down into the mining pit and through his efforts saved all of the trapped miners. For his heroism that October day, he received the Carnegie Medal. As time passed and age brought him bodily afflictions, Dr. Andrews amazed his patients by his refusal to stop practicing, even after suffering a stroke in 1939. Somehow, too, he was able to maintain his regimen of running a mile a day before breakfast, almost up to the day that he died in 1944. The final name on the honor roster of Illinois' black citizens is that of Robert Sengstack Abbott, the founder and editor of the Chicago Defender, a paper bearing the self-styled distinction of being, quote, the world's greatest weekly, unquote. Abbott first visited Chicago when he was serving as a tenor in the Hampton Institute Quartet. Like many others, he returned to attend Colored American Day at the World's Fair in August 1893. At the fair, he heard Frederick Douglass's impassioned speech, he listened to Will Marion Cook's excellent violin solo, and he met the young poet Paul Laurence Dunbar. On the occasion of his 1893 visit, he also took time to assess the possibilities of launching a career as a printer in Chicago. Evidently, he thought that the prospects were good, for after graduating from Hampton as a fully qualified printer, he returned to Chicago in 1897. But it seemed that no one wanted a black printer, and the young man then decided to study law. Here, too, there was only frustration. But when he hung out his shingle, no one came. It was at this point in his life that he decided to print and issue his own newspaper. Accordingly, on May 6, 1905, Abbott peddled on the street and from door to door the first issue of his four-page paper, which he called the Chicago Defender. With careful management, the paper's circulation grew steadily until World War I, when Abbott began to vigorously advocate a Negro exodus out of the South. In his paper, he called it the Great Northern Drive. And between 1916 and 1920, the Defender's circulation leaped to an all-time high of 500,000. Abbott made the Defender a Bible, written to lure black Southerners out of the cotton fields into a new land of Canaan. Every edition bore a message for the Southern black, urging him to leave the land of tyranny and come to the land of freedom. Only in the North, the Defender editorialized, could a black live with dignity and be an upstanding citizen of his community. And at times there were poetic lures to catch the vacillating reader's attention. Some are coming on the passenger, some are coming on the freight. Others will be found walking, for none have time to wait. The success of the Defender's advocacy of the Great Northern Drive was attested to by the strong reaction against the paper throughout the South. For instance, in an Athens, Georgia daily paper, one writer called the Chicago Weekly, quote, "the greatest disturbing element that has yet entered Georgia," unquote. Abbott also made the Defender an organ of racial protest. Every edition carried the slogan, "American race prejudice must be destroyed." And every edition specified what the Negro wanted in America. Quote, "the opening up of all trades and trade unions to blacks, representation in the president's cabinet, engineers and conductors on all American railroads," unquote. Inevitably, the Defender attracted the best of Negro talent. Indeed, its roster of sometime columnists reads like a who is who in black America: Du Bois, Langston Hughes, Walter White, Jackie Robinson, and many others. Robert Abbott died in 1940. He had lived long enough to see the full after effects of World War I's great migration from south to north and from farm to city. Given the same options and choices, one wonders, with World War II an imminent reality, whether the Defender under his editorship would have advocated another great Northern drive. The irony of it all is that a World War II great migration did occur, once more moving blacks from farm to city and from south to north and from south to west, and it occurred without any special journalistic pleading. Somehow, one tends to think that had he lived, Robert Abbott would have had serious second thoughts about a second great Northern drive. These are, then, the principal events in a summary form marking the black man's history in Illinois, and I have included short sketches of the lives of some of the more exciting participants in that history. Had time permitted, many others could have been cited for their contributions: poets, jurists, teachers, musicians, revolutionaries, bankers, entertainers. Of all of them, one can say, they came, they saw, and they survived.
And that concludes Bicentennial 2, The Impact of the Afro-American in Illinois, with Professor Richard Barksdale. On Bicentennial 3, The Appalachian Culture in Ohio. This program was produced by the Humanities Series, Midwestern Center at WHA, a service of the University of Wisconsin Telecommunications Center. Thank you.